Hostilities could break out at any time, for no apparent cause other than the restlessness of the young warriors, spurred by their desire for honor and glory, which could only be won on raids, which always brought on revenge raids, in a regular cycle. The captains were hopelessly naive on this point. Lewis was sure he had created a peace in the face of overwhelming evidence that his words were carried away by the wind. He told Laroque of his confidence in his very grand plan, but Laroque had doubts, and rightly so. The truth was right in front of Lewis. He later recorded that, during this meeting with the Hidatsas, "I was pointing out to them the advantages of a state of peace with their neighbors. The chiefs who had already gathered their harvest of laurels and having forcibly felt in many instances some of those inconveniences attending a state of war, readily agreed with me." That was easy enough. Old men seldom want war. But a young fellow asked me if they were in a state of peace with all their neighbors, what the nation would do for chiefs. The teenage warrior pointed out that the old chiefs must shortly die, and that the nation could not exist without chiefs, and the Hidatsas could not choose chiefs without witnessing the achievements of the contending warriors. Lewis had other difficulties with the Hidatsas. They may have believed his protestations that the Americans meant them no harm, but they resented the lack of presence, and resented even more what one of them called the high-sounding language the American captains bestowed upon themselves and their nation, wishing to impress the Indians with an idea that they were great warriors and a powerful people who, if exasperated, could crush all the nations of the earth. Such boasting did not sit well with the proud Hidatsas. On the morning of November 30th, Amandin came to the fort with an alarming report. A raiding party of Sioux and Arikaras had attacked 5 Mandan hunters, killing 1, wounding 2 others, and stealing 9 horses. This was dismaying news to the peacemakers, for it indicated that the Arikaras had broken their promise and realigned themselves with the Sioux, and that those old allies were making war against the Mandans. This was welcome news, too, however, because it provided the Americans with an opportunity to show their support of the Mandans and to display the kind of firepower they could bring to bear against tribes that displeased them. The captains acted at once. Lewis took charge at Fort Mandan, while Clark marched across the frozen river at the head of a 21-man detachment of soldiers to come to the aid of the Mandans. The Mandans were not interested. They told Clark the snow was too deep, and anyway the Sioux had too much of a head start. Then they chastised the Americans for meddling in their affairs. The Mandans had believed Clark and Lewis, and had gone out to hunt in small parties, thinking themselves safe. And now look what had happened. One chief said he had always known that the Arikaras were liars. They were liars. Clark was not ready to see the peace policy defeated by one small raid. He again proposed pursuit and was again turned down. Then he made a case for the Arikaras. He admitted that some bad men from the Arikaras may have been with the Sioux, but you know there is bad men in all nations. Do not get mad with the Arikaras until we know if those bad men are counternounced by their nation. Clark could talk all he wanted. The Mandans knew what had happened and drew their own conclusions. Clark and Lewis were meddling in affairs they did not understand, but the Mandans were patient with them. And protective, too, although the captains hated to admit it. The expedition ate an enormous amount every day, and more every day as winter came on and it got colder, dipping down below zero frequently. To get through the winter, the Americans were going to need large quantities of Indian corn, beans, and squash, and they were going to have to find a regular supply of meat. On December 7th, a Mandan chief came to the fort to report that there were great numbers of buffalo on the hills a couple of miles or so away from the river. The chief offered horses for the soldiers and asked if the Americans would like to join the Mandans on a hunt. Lewis gathered a party of 15 men and, on the borrowed Mandan horses, went out to join the hunt. The Indians as riders put the Americans in the shade, even Americans from Virginia. Riding bareback at breakneck speed, chasing the fleeing buffalo, they could guide their horses with their knees, leaving their hands free to shoot their arrows, which they did with such force that often an arrow would go right through the buffalo. Squaws came after to butcher the animal before the wolves could get to the carcass. Using rifles, Lewis and his men killed 11 buffalo that day. He enjoyed it so much he stayed out all night, apparently sleeping in a buffalo robe in below-zero weather. The next day, the Americans killed 9 more buffalo. They ate only the tongues. The wolves got the rest. "We lived on the fat of the land," Mackenzie wrote. "Hunting and eating were the order of the day." That day, the temperature went down to 45 below zero, the coldest it would get all winter. And winter was still 13 days away. Chapter 16. Winter at Fort Mandan. December 21, 1804 to March 21, 1805. It was always cold, often brutally cold. Sometimes so cold a man's penis would freeze if he wasn't quick about it. Lewis kept a weather diary in which he faithfully recorded the day's temperature at sunrise and at 4 o'clock p.m., as well as the conditions, fair, cloudy, snow, hail, and CARS to indicate cloudy after rain and snow, wind direction and force, and the rise and fall of the river. This was the first collection of weather data from west of the Mississippi River. It recorded a somewhat colder winter than the norm during the 30-year period 1951 to 80, when December, January, and February temperatures averaged 12.3 degrees above zero. In 1804 to 5, it averaged 4 degrees above zero for December, 3.4 degrees below for January, and 11.3 degrees above for February, or an average for the winter of 4 degrees above zero. The Indians could take it. On various occasions, the Americans would hear of or meet Indians who had spent the night out on the prairie without a fire and with only a buffalo robe to cover them, and only thin moccasins and antelope leggings and shirt to wear, and hardly suffer from it. On January 10, 1805, Clark reported 2 such incidents and commented, "Customs and the habits of those people has answered to bear more cold than I thought it possible for man to endure." The river was frozen solid enough so that great herds of buffalo could cross without breaking through. Lewis wanted to pull the keelboat on shore for repairs, but it was locked into the ice. Beginning on February 3rd, he tried various expedients to free it, chipping it out with axes, freeing it by means of boiling water and hot stones, or cutting it loose with a parcel of iron spikes. At each attempt, he had a windlass and a large rope of elk skin ready to haul her up on the bank when freed from the ice. But it took weeks to break her free. Not until February 26 did the party finally get the boat out of the water. Why they didn't pull the boat out before the river iced over, neither of the captains ever bothered to explain. Such extreme cold, one might have thought, would have induced the captains and the men to spend the winter in a state of semi-hibernation, seldom venturing away from their fires or out of their huts, which Ordway described as warm and comfortable. But the captains kept the men busy, both because there was lots of real work that had to be done, and because they were good officers who knew for a certainty that an idle soldier is a bored soldier heading for trouble. Larocq, Mackenzie, and other British traders could have told the captains about the troubles at Hudson's Bay Company and Northwest Company posts during the winter, the trappers shut up in their huts, small smoky rooms illuminated only by candlelight. Such conditions led to bad temper, fistfights, ill will, and lack of discipline. But the Corps of Discovery was not a wandering band of trappers, it was an infantry company of the U.S. Army. Still, Clark and Lewis had seen plenty of trouble at Wood River the previous winter, and bad as the weather had been in Illinois, it was nothing compared with North Dakota. Yet at Fort Mandan there were no fights, no desertions. The worst infraction was relatively minor. On February 9th, Private Thomas Howard got back to the fort after dark. Rather than call out to the guard to have the gate opened, he scaled the wall. Unfortunately for Howard, an Indian was looking on, and shortly thereafter climbed the wall himself. The guard reported these doings to Captain Lewis. Lewis was much alarmed. Although relations with the Mandans were excellent, they were not so good with the Hidatsas, and in any case the Mandans might decide at any moment to take advantage of their overwhelming numbers, overpower the expedition, and help themselves to the treasure trove of rifles, kettles, trade goods, and the rest. Private Howard's thoughtless act had just revealed to the Indians how easy it was to scale the wall. Lewis's first thought was to leave Howard until later and deal with the threat immediately, by convincing the Indian who had followed him over the wall that what he had done was a bad idea. He had the man brought to him. "I convinced him of the impropriety of his conduct," Lewis recorded, "and explained to him the risk he had run of being severely treated. The fellow appeared much alarmed. I gave him a small piece of tobacco and sent him away." Then he turned to Private Howard. He had Howard put under arrest and ordered him tried by a court-martial. Lewis was not inclined to be lenient because, "This man is an old soldier, which still heightens this offense." In the morning, Howard was charged with setting a pernicious example to the savages. He was found guilty and sentenced to 50 lashes, a heavy punishment for an offense that amounted simply to thoughtlessness. Perhaps for that reason the court recommended mercy, and Lewis forgave Howard the lashing. That was the only court-martial held at Fort Mandan, and the last on the entire expedition. The garrison at Fort Mandan maintained regular military security with drills, sentry posting, challenges, daily inspection of the weapons, and the rest. When the temperature went well below zero, sentries were replaced every half hour. Aside from the possibility of a hostile move by Mandans and Hidatsas, the Sioux were definitely hostile and not so far away that they couldn't stage a raid, and the Arikaras might join them. So the expedition stayed constantly on guard. The Sioux did make a raid in mid-February. Clark had gone out on a 9-day hunt with a large party of men. The hunters killed more meat than they could transport. When Clark got back to Fort Mandan, he dispatched Driard with 3 men and 3 horse-drawn sleighs to retrieve the carcasses. A band of Sioux warriors spied the small party. Clark's description of what happened next, based on Driard's testimony, tantalizes rather than satisfies our curiosity about how it went. "About 105 Indians rushed on them and cut their horses from the sleighs, 2 of which they carried off in great haste. The 3rd horse was given up to the party by the Indians for fear of some of the Indians being killed by our men, who were not disposed to be robbed of all they had tamely." However determined the party, the Indians got away with the 2 sleighs and 2 knives. However bold the Indians, they were forced to give back a tomahawk and 1 horse and sleigh. So the Americans didn't do too badly, given that the encounter pitted 105 warriors against 4 men, Driard, Privates Robert Frazier and Silas Goodrich, and Newman, who was not allowed to carry a weapon. At the end of November, Clark had led a party to punish the Sioux and Arikaras for attacking the Mandans. This time it was Lewis's turn to go on the warpath. He set out at sunrise, February 15th, at the head of 24 volunteers, including a few Mandan warriors coming along as allies, to find and punish the Sioux. But the weather was bad, the snow was deep, and the men soon had their feet cut and bleeding on the sharp ice. The Mandans told Lewis the trail was cold and the cause hopeless, and they abandoned the search. Lewis, always persistent, doggedly kept on, covering 30 miles before he discovered 2 abandoned teepees. Thoroughly exhausted, the party slept in them. The next day, Lewis finally abandoned the search and instead went hunting. The party stayed out all week and brought back more than 1 ton of meat. 36 deer, 14 elk. Encounters with the Mandans were altogether different. The neighbors got along just fine. The chiefs and captains, warriors and men, called on one another, went hunting together, traded extensively, enjoyed sexual relations with the same women on a regular basis, joked and talked, as best they could through the language barrier, about what they knew. They managed to describe wonders to one another, using their hands to illustrate their points, drawing maps, mountains, or wooden houses on the dirt floor of the lodge, educating one another. The Mandans and the Hidatsas knew something of the country to the west and were glad to share their knowledge with the captains. The Americans knew the country to the east of the Mississippi River and were eager to induce some Mandan and Hidatsa chiefs to make the journey to Washington. Holidays and special occasions brought the red and white men closer together. On New Year's Day, 1805, half the detachment went to the Lower Mandan village, at the particular request of the chief, to dance to the music of a tambourine, a sounding horn, and Private Crusade's fiddle. The Indians enjoyed the music and the dancing, especially the Frenchman, who danced on his hands. Toward noon, Clark and York arrived at the village, where festivities were in full swing. Clark called on York to dance, which amused the crowd very much and somewhat astonished them that so large a man should be so active. The following day, it was Lewis's turn. He led the party of musicians and dancers to the second Mandan village for more of what Sergeant Ordway called frolicking. From January 3rd to 5th, the Mandans held a nightly dance of their own. They invited the garrison to join them. When the men arrived, they were ushered to the back of the communal earth lodge. The dance began. To the music of rattles and drums, the old men of the village, dressed in their finery, entered the lodge, gathered into a circle, sat down, and waited. Soon the young men and their wives filed in to take their places at the back of the circle. They fixed pipes for the old men, and a smoking ceremony ensued. As the drumbeat became more insistent and the chanting swelled, one of the youngsters would approach an old man and beg him to take his wife, who in her turn would appear naked before the elder. She would lead him by the hand and... But let Clark tell it, as only he can. The girl then takes the old man, who very often can scarcely walk, and leads him to a convenient place for the business, after which they return to the lodge. In the event that the old man failed to gratify the wife, the husband would offer her again and again, and throw a robe into the bargain, and beg the old man not to despise the couple. All this, Clark noted, is to cause the buffalo to come near so that they may kill them. In the winter, the herds migrated far and wide in search of wind-blown bare spots where they could get at the grass. The buffalo dance was thought to be a magnet to the wandering herds. There was a second purpose to the dance. The Mandans believed that power, in this case the hunting abilities of the old men, could be transferred from one man to another through sexual relations with the same woman. To the great good luck of the enlisted men, the Mandans attributed to the whites great powers and big medicine. So, throughout the three-day buffalo dance, the Americans were said to be untiringly zealous in attracting the cow and in transferring power. One unnamed private made four contributions. Sure enough, there was a good buffalo hunt a few days later. Much about the Mandans was curious or inexplicable. Lewis was especially struck by their treatment of their horses. When some Mandan ponies on loan to the Americans arrived at the fort late on February 12th, they appeared so much fatigued that Lewis ordered them fed corn moistened with a little water, but to my astonishment found that they would not eat it, but preferred the bark of the cottonwood which forms the principal article of food usually given them by their Indian masters in the winter season. The Mandans, according to Lewis, are invariably severe riders, and frequently, for many days in pursuing the buffalo, they, the horses, are seldom suffered to taste food. After the hunt, the Indians brought their horses into their lodges for the night, where the animals were given what Lewis regarded as a scanty allowance of cottonwood ranging from the size of a man's finger to that of his arm. Lewis could hardly believe that a horse could exist long under such circumstances, but he had seen with his own eyes and knew it to be a fact that the Mandan horses are seldom seen meager or unfit for service. Lewis's long essay on Mandan horsemanship was the last in a series of 10 journal entries he made beginning on February 3rd. That was the day Clark set out with 16 men on a 9-day hunting expedition. In no way does Lewis indicate that because Clark was gone from Fort Mandan, it had become his responsibility to keep up the journal, but since the Lewis journal stopped when Clark returned, it seems likely that is what happened. If so, Lewis was not keeping a regular journal in the winter of 1804-5, although he was doing a great deal of writing in the form of reports to Jefferson. He was also doing a good deal of doctoring. On the first day of winter, a Mandan woman brought her child to Lewis, showed him an abscess on the child's back, and offered Lewis as much corn as she could carry for some medicine to cure the sore. Lewis complied. On January 10th, a 13-year-old Mandan boy came to the fort with frozen feet. The captains used a standard treatment, soaking the feet in cold water. It appeared to work. It did with the men, who had frequent cases of frozen toes and fingers, but always recovered. In this case, however, the boy was too far gone. On January 26th, Clark recorded that Captain Lewis took off the toes of 1 foot of the boy who got frostbit some time ago. Dr. E.G. Chouinard, whose medical history of the expedition all Lewis and Clark scholars turn to when the subject is doctoring, comments, "Probably the necrotic tissue had demarcated in the 2 weeks since his toes were frozen, and probably the amputations done by Lewis consisted of plucking loose the dead tissue, possibly disarticulating the joints, and possibly having to sever tendons." 5 days later, the captains sawed off the boy's toes from the other foot. How it was done, they don't say. Dr. Chouinard notes that a surgical saw was not listed in the medical kit and speculates that one of the 2 handsaws was used. However it was done, more than 3 weeks later, on February 23rd, Clark reported, "The father of the boy whose feet were froze near this place and nearly cured by us took him home in a sleigh." Aside from frozen skin and extremities, the most common medical problem the captains faced was syphilis. Few details come down in the journals, but it is possible that nearly every man suffered from the disease. As for the captains, they never mention taking the standard treatment themselves. That treatment consisted of ingesting mercury in the form of a pill called calomel, mercurous chloride. The side effects of mercury could be dangerous. The phrase "mad as a hatter" referred to hat makers who used mercury in the process of their work and became a bit crazy from breathing in all those fumes. But it was sovereign for syphilis, and Lewis knew this and administered it routinely. The captains applied all their treatments on the principle that more is better. On January 26th, one of the men was taken violently bad with the pleurisy. How he survived the captain's treatment is a wonder. They bled him, purged him with Rush's pills, and greased his chest, which might actually have done some good. He was still suffering the next day, so Clark bled him again and then put him into a sweat lodge, where water was splashed onto hot rocks to produce a sauna. And that must have done some good, for the patient is not again mentioned. Lewis's most unusual experience as a doctor came on February 11th, when he was present at the labor of one of Charbonneau's wives, Sacajawea. Lewis noted that this was the first child which this woman had borne, and as is common in such cases, her labor was tedious and the pain violent. Lewis worried about her because he was counting on her as a translator with the Shoshone Indians, known by Lewis to be rich in horses, when he got to the mountains. He consulted with Jessome, who said that in such cases it was his practice to administer a small portion of the rattle of the rattlesnake. According to Jessome, it always worked. "Having the rattle of a snake by me," Lewis wrote in his journal, "he broke the rattles into small pieces and mixed them with some water, which Sacajawea then drank. Whether this medicine was truly the cause or not, I shall not undertake to determine," Lewis said, "but she had not taken it more than 10 minutes before she brought forth." In a sentence itself pregnant with hope, but tempered by a skepticism befitting a scientist of the Enlightenment, Lewis wrote, "This remedy may be worthy of future experiments, but I must confess that I want faith as to its efficacy." The baby, a boy named Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, was healthy and active. The family had its own hut inside Fort Mandan, so the cries of a hungry infant rang through the parade ground and surely caused at least some pangs of homesickness among at least a few of the men, as they remembered their own families and their own little brothers or sisters. Siblings were very much on Lewis's mind. In a long letter to his mother about this time, he gave over a special section to his siblings. Charbonneau, the new father, was all set up by what he had done and was coming to have a wholly new view of his own importance. Quite probably this escalation in self-importance was fed by the conversations he translated through the winter between the captains and the Indians. From the captains' questions about what lay out west and the Indians' answers, Charbonneau knew that Sacajawea was critical to dealing with the Shoshones, and without Charbonneau, no Sacajawea. So, on March 11th, when the captain sat down with Charbonneau to make a contract, it was Charbonneau who took the high ground and tried to dictate the terms. The captain said he would have to pitch in and do all the work the enlisted men had to do, and would have to stand a regular guard. Charbonneau replied that, "Let our situation be what it may, he will not agree to work or stand a guard." There was more. If miffed with any man, he wishes to return when he pleases, also have the disposal of as much provisions as he chooses to carry. Inadmissible, Clark and Lewis flatly declared. They told Charbonneau to move out of the fort, taking his family with him, and they hired Mr. Gravelines as interpreter. After 4 days of living in the Mandan village, Charbonneau sent a message to the captains via one of the Frenchmen to excuse his simplicity and take him into the service. Did he come to his senses on his own, or did the Frenchman tell him what a fool he was, what a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity he was passing up? Or was it Sacagawea who said she absolutely had to go see her people and participate in this great adventure? However it happened, Charbonneau was ready to crawl. The captain sent word for him to come to the fort for a discussion. He showed up on March 17th. "We called him in," Clark reported. "He agreed to our terms, and we agreed that he might go on with us, etc., etc." The roster for the expedition was complete. The permanent party that was getting ready to head west consisted of the 3 squads of enlisted men, each with its sergeant, plus the 2 captains, and 5 persons from outside the military establishment, namely Driard, York, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and Jean-Baptiste, nicknamed Pomp or Pompey by Clark. By February 4th, Lewis noted in his journal, the expedition had run out of meat. That morning, Clark set out on his hunting expedition. The next day, Lewis reported that the immediate problem of scanty provisions had been overcome, although not with meat but with corn, and thanks to a bellows rather than a rifle. Private John Shields was a skilled blacksmith. He had set up for business at the expedition's forge and bellows inside the fort. There he mended iron hoes, sharpened axes, and repaired firearms for the Indians in exchange for corn. But by the end of January, business was turning sour. The market for mending hoes had been satisfied. Shields needed some new product to attract business. The arms trade was the obvious answer. Not in firearms, the captains turned away all requests for rifles or pistols, but in battle axes. There was a particular form of battle axe highly prized by the Indians and easily made by Shields. Lewis disapproved of the design, writing that it was formed in a very inconvenient manner, in my opinion. The blade was too thin and too long, the handle too short, the overall weight too little, all of which combined to make a weapon that made an uncertain and easily avoided stroke. But arms merchants give the customer what he wants. Shields went to work, getting his sheet iron from an all but burned out stove. Some of the men were detailed to cutting timber to provide wood to make a charcoal kiln to expand production capacity. Still, the Americans couldn't turn out battle axes fast enough. The Indians were skilled traders who drove hard bargains. On February 6th, Lewis had Shields cut up what was left of the stove into pieces of 4 inches square, which could then be worked into arrow points or buffalo hide scrapers. After some haggling, a price was set, 7 to 8 gallons of corn for each piece of metal. Each side thought it had made a great bargain. In his February 6th journal entry, Lewis paid tribute to Shields and his helpers. "The blacksmiths take a considerable quantity of corn today in payment for their labor. The blacksmiths have proved a happy resource to us in our present situation, as I believe it would have been difficult to have devised any other method to have procured corn from the natives." Lewis gave the full credit to Shields when he might well have split it, giving at least some to the Indians for having the corn available in the first place. Working as hard as they did in such extreme cold weather, the men ate prodigiously, 6,000 calories or even more per day. A modern athlete seldom consumes more than 5,000, but the calories the men were getting in 1805 contained very little, if any, fat. Consequently, no matter how much they ate, the men were always hungry. It was Mandan corn that got the expedition through the winter. Had the Mandans not been there, or had they had no corn to spare, or had they been hostile, the Lewis and Clark expedition might not have survived its first winter. Lewis never put it that way, and in fact probably never thought of it that way. 2 days after writing the passage praising Shields for procuring corn, Lewis had a visit from the chief of the Upper Mandan village, Black Cat. Lewis had been with him in Black Cat's village on January 2nd and other occasions. This was Black Cat's 17th visit to Fort Mandan. He brought presents, including a fine bow. Lewis gave him some fishing hooks and some ribbon. Black Cat's squaw gave Lewis two pairs of handsome moccasins. He gave her a mirror and a couple of needles. Black Cat stayed to dine at the captain's quarters. That evening, Lewis wrote in his journal, "This man possesses more integrity, firmness, intelligence, and perspicuity of mind than any Indian I have met within this quarter, and I think with a little management he may be made a useful agent in furthering the views of our government." A remarkable sentence. In the first half, Lewis obviously was speaking from the heart. Clearly, he enjoyed being with and greatly respected Black Cat. Yet in the second half of the sentence, he blandly discusses his plans to manage and manipulate his friend for the benefit of the United States. A further problem is this. What were the views of the Americans? On the one hand, peace. Lewis and Clark always preached peace to the Indians, giving them what the Americans thought of as overwhelmingly powerful reasons to avoid war. On the other hand, the Americans were arms merchants. As James Ronda puts it, "Typical of this dilemma was the request from a war chief who came to purchase an axe and obtain permission to attack Sioux and Arikara warriors. For the proper price in corn, the axe was handed over, but the request to use it was denied." The Hidatsa chief must have wondered what sort of man would sell arms to a warrior and then tell him not to engage the enemy. The winter at Fort Mandan involved hunting, trading, keeping fit, dealing with the cold, doing extensive repairs to old equipment and building new canoes, visiting the Indians, and much more. But for Meriwether Lewis, it was primarily a winter of scholarship, of research and writing. For most of the day, most days, he was involved in gathering information or writing down what he had learned. He had endless discussions with the Indians about what lay out west, or what this or that faraway tribe was like. Or he bent over his writing desk in his smoky room, with a candle for illumination, dipped his quill into the inkstand, and wrote for hours on end. His subject was America west of the Mississippi River. He wrote about what he had seen and learned, and what he had heard. He tried to think like Jefferson, to anticipate what the president would want to know, or to guess how the president would present this or that subject. And what of Jefferson, meanwhile? What did he know about where the expedition was and how it was doing? Precious little. He had no direct word from Lewis after the expedition left St. Charles. The Osage chiefs, whose visit Lewis had arranged, arrived in Washington in July 1804. In greeting them, Jefferson spoke of his beloved man, Captain Lewis. On January 4, 1805, Jefferson wrote Lewis's brother, Reuben, to report that he had just learned, apparently by word of mouth, via a trapper who had returned to St. Louis that fall, that on August 19th the expedition was near the mouth of the Platte. According to the report, no accident had happened, and he, Lewis, had been well received by all the Indians on his way. It was expected that he would winter with the Mandans, 1,300 miles up the river. Jefferson predicted that the expedition would reach the Pacific during the coming summer, then return to the Mandan villages for the winter of 1805-6. If so, the president cheerfully concluded, we may expect to see him in the fall of 1806. Chapter 17. Report from Fort Mandan, March 22 to April 6, 1805. New life was stirring. On the first day of spring it rained, the first rain since fall. The river ice began to break up. Ducks, swans, and geese sometimes seemed to fill the sky. The Indians set fire to the dry grass to encourage new grass to come up, for the benefit of their horses and to attract the buffalo. By the end of March, the ice was coming down in great chunks, along with drowned buffalo who had been on the ice when it gave way. I observed extraordinary dexterity of the Indians in jumping from one cake of ice to another, Clark wrote on the 30th, for the purpose of catching the buffalo as they float down. The joy of spring was everywhere, and doubly welcome by the men of the expedition, who had just survived the coldest winter any of them had ever known. They worked with enthusiasm, eager to get going again. Teams of men were repairing the boat, while others were building canoes, packing, making moccasins, making jerky, pumping the bellows. They sang as they worked. In the 5 months between May and October 1804, the captains and their men had traveled more miles than many of their contemporaries would do in a lifetime. In the 5 months between November 1804 and April 1805, they had stayed in one place. The anticipation of getting going on the river again was so keen it was almost unbearable. On the last day of March, Clark wrote, "All the party in high spirits, but a few nights pass without a dance. Possessing perfect harmony and good understanding towards each other. Generally healthy, except venereal's complaints, which is very common." On April 5th, the keelboat and the two pirogues that had come down the Ohio and then up the Mississippi and Missouri to Fort Mandan, along with 6 new canoes, were put into the water. They would be packed the next day, then set off on April 7th, the keelboat headed downstream for St. Louis, while the two pirogues and the lighter and more maneuverable canoes headed upstream, where the river would gradually become shallower and swifter. As the men went about their work, the captains wrote. So much writing did they do that Clark complained he had no time to write his family. Lewis managed to work in a letter to his mother, but most of it was unoriginal. He just copied passages from his report to Jefferson. The captains worked with passion and dedication. For several weeks, Lewis did nothing but write, eat, and sleep. There was so much to say. He felt he needed to justify the expedition. He wanted to please Jefferson, to be able to report that they had discovered what he had hoped they would, to answer his questions, to promote his program for the development of Louisiana. Even more, the captains wanted to be accurate in all their observations. They were men of the Enlightenment, dedicated to collecting facts and then putting the new knowledge to work for the good of mankind. So, in addition to describing the geography, the soils, the minerals, the climate, they had the responsibility of describing the tribes and of making recommendations on the economic future of Louisiana. They needed to make available in permanent form as much as they could of what they had learned. Lewis was determined to get these jobs done and done right. In his mind, everything that had happened since Jefferson put him in command was preliminary to the expedition, which was only now about to begin. On April 7th, the Corps of Discovery would set out into territory no white man had entered. Thus far, as Gary Moulton writes, all the men's efforts had been directed to reaching a point where other whites had ventured before them on a route already mapped. But although the expedition had yet to do any exploring, the captains had managed to pick up a tremendous amount of new information on Upper Louisiana, its flora and fauna, its climate and fertility, its peoples and their wars and their economies. Put together correctly and properly organized and labeled, all this information would constitute the first systematic survey of the Trans-Mississippi West and would thus provide an invaluable contribution to the world's knowledge, and equally invaluable to the United States government and American businessmen, frontier farmers, fur traders, and adventurers. The captains collected information in 2 basic ways. First and foremost, from their own observations. Second, by making local inquiry. They asked questions about the surrounding country of every Indian and white trader they met. These information-gathering sessions sometimes lasted a full day, occasionally even longer. Jefferson had a passion for Indian language, believing he would be able to trace the Indians' origins by discovering the basis of their language. So the gathering of vocabularies was an important charge on the captains. They put a major effort into attempting to render words from various Indian languages into an English spelling. Mackenzie was present once to see the captains at work on their vocabularies. The language being recorded was Hidatsa. A native speaker would say a word to Sacagawea, who would pass it on in Hidatsa to Charbonneau, who would pass it on in French to Gisome, who would translate it into English for the captains. Mackenzie thought Gisome's English ranged somewhere between inadequate and non-existent, magnifying the chances for error. On another occasion, Mackenzie wrote, "I was present when vocabularies were being made of the Mandans. The two Frenchmen, Charbonneau and Gisome, had warm disputes upon the meaning of every word that was taken down by the captains. As the Indians could not well comprehend the intention of recording their words, they concluded that the Americans had a wicked design upon their country. Despite the difficulties, Lewis kept at it. He put in immense amounts of time on the task. Whether he found the work interesting or thought it important cannot be said. It sufficed that Mr. Jefferson wanted it done. Lewis was relatively uninterested in Indian mythology or spiritual life, but he was a skilled observer of some parts of Indian culture, especially how things were done. One of his contributions, for example, was a graphic and precise description of glass bead-making among the Arikaras. As the expedition prepared to depart for the mountains, the captains purchased a buffalo skin teepee to provide shelter for themselves, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and Pomp. Lewis described it in his journal entry of April 7, 1805, in what James Rhonda characterized as one of the best descriptions yet drafted of that distinctive plains dwelling. In addition to their written descriptions, the captains gathered such objects as Arikara corn, tobacco seeds, mineral and botanical specimens, along with artifacts from Indian life, including bows, clothing, and painted robes, to be sent to Jefferson. Altogether, the amount of information they gathered, organized and presented in a systematic fashion to Jefferson, and beyond him to the scientific world, was enough to justify the expedition, even if it made not a single further contribution. The model for Lewis and Clark's report was Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia. Like that work, written a quarter century earlier, Lewis's description of Upper Louisiana was part guidebook, part travelogue, part booster-like promotion, part text to accompany the master map. Adding in Clark's contributions, the final report from Fort Mandan totaled something close to 45,000 words, almost book length. Jefferson's notes ran to some 80,000 words. Like Jefferson, Lewis began with a detailed account of the waterways, or, as he put it, a summary view of the rivers and creeks which discharge themselves into the Missouri, from the junction of that river with the Mississippi to Fort Mandan. As Jefferson had done for Virginia, Lewis described not only the tributaries but the people living along the rivers, whether the French at St. Charles, or the Otoes, or the Sioux. He included information on the local economy, the soil, mineral deposits, climate, and more. The report combined the captain's actual observations of the various rivers flowing into the Missouri with information received from traders and Indians about the upper reaches of those streams and their own principal tributaries. For example, Lewis saw only the mouth of the Platte River, but he described it up to its head in the mountains. From what he had been told, he said, the Platte ran through immense level and fertile plains and meadows, in which no timber is to be seen except on its own borders. He named five major tributaries of the Platte, discussed the mineral deposits in its drainage, the soil, the people, Otoes and Missouris, and more. Naturally, the farther west Lewis's report ventured, the more speculative it became. His conjecture about the Platte's relationship to Santa Fe and to the Black Hills was purely imaginative and badly wrong. Lewis expected that Jefferson would have his work printed and distributed as a report to Congress, and he knew something about the audience for the work, so on occasion he sounded like a promoter writing a broadside. This river, the Muddy in eastern Missouri, waters a most delightful country. The land lies well for cultivation and is fertile in the extreme, covered with lofty and excellent timber, and supplied with an abundance of fine, bold springs of limestone water. The Grand River, farther west, was also prime farm country. The lands are extremely fertile, consisting of a happy mixture of prairies and groves, exhibiting one of the most beautiful and picturesque scenes that I ever beheld. Enthusiastic as he was in his report about the lower Missouri country, he made it sound almost like heaven, he actually was holding back his emotions. In his letter to his mother, dated March 21, 1804, he allowed himself to rhapsodize about the country, writing not so much as son to mother as Virginia planter to Virginia planter. "This immense river, so far as we have yet ascended," he wrote, "waters one of the fairest portions of the globe, nor do I believe that there is in the universe a similar extent of country, equally fertile, well watered, and intersected by such a number of navigable streams." He added, "I had been led to believe that the open prairie country was barren, sterile, and sandy, but on the contrary, I found it fertile in the extreme, the soil being from 1 to 20 feet in depth, consisting of a fine black loam that produces a luxuriant growth of grass and other vegetables. The plains were not quite Eden, however. The absence of timber was a serious drawback, for it was almost unimaginable for any American in 1805 to live in a country without plenty of lumber and fuel. Indeed, in the eastern third of the United States, too much timber was the problem. In his report to Jefferson, Lewis took note of all the things that would spring to the mind of a frontier farmer hankering to move into Upper Louisiana. He pointed out several rapids well situated for waterworks. He warned against areas that had tolerably fertile soil but no timber. Lewis was an advance man for the American fur trappers and traders as well as farmers. He noted the furs available and scouted likely spots for trading posts. One of Lewis's responsibilities was to make recommendations on how to drive the British away from the Missouri so that American companies could take over the fur trade. His analysis of the economic political situation on the river led him directly to his conclusion and recommendation. "I am perfectly convinced that until such measures are taken by our government as will effectually prohibit all intercourse or traffic with the Sioux and the British fur companies," he reported to Jefferson, "the citizens of the United States can never enjoy but partially those important advantages which the navigation of the Missouri now presents." He recommended establishing garrisons in places where the soldiers could stop the British from coming into Dakota from Canada or across today's Minnesota. If trade between the British and the Sioux was prohibited for a few years, he wrote, "The Sioux will be made to feel their dependence on the will of our government for their supplies of merchandise, and in the course of 2 or 3 years, they may most probably be reduced to order without the necessity of bloodshed." Given what happened in Sioux-American relations over the following 71 years, that was a hopelessly optimistic prediction. Much of the report was a business prospectus, with the emphasis on the Indian as customer and supplier. In a separate section, written in Clark's hand but the product of both men's labor, entitled Estimate of the Eastern Indians, the captains described no fewer than 72 different tribes and bands, with at least some information on where they lived, how they lived, who they were at war with, their numbers, their dwellings, and more. Of course, the captains could only describe a few tribes from first-hand knowledge, but they made clear where their information was word of mouth. Those they knew, they did not hesitate to characterize, often in a heartfelt fashion. They wrote of their friends the Mandans, "These are the most friendly, well-disposed Indians inhabiting the Missouri. They are brave, humane, and hospitable." Of the Teton Sioux, the opposite. "These are the vilest miscreants of the savage race, and must ever remain the pirates of the Missouri, until such measures are pursued by our government as will make them feel a dependence on its will for their supply of merchandise." Of the tribes living along the route they intended to follow, they wrote of the mountain-dwelling Flatheads, "They are a timid, inoffensive, and defenseless people. They are said to possess an abundance of horses." Of the Shoshones, the captain's information indicated that they traded with the Spanish, who refused to give them firearms. Consequently, although the Shoshones were a very numerous and well-disposed people, "all the nations on the Missouris below make war on them and steal their horses." Of the Nez Perce, "Still less is known of these people or their country. The water courses on which they reside are supposed to be branches of the Columbia River." Along with the written report, the captain sent back to Jefferson 108 botanical specimens to add to the collections at the American Philosophical Society, all properly labeled as to where and when collected and described. The first was a species of cress taken at St. Louis, May 10, 1804. It is common in the open grounds on the Mississippi bottoms, appears in the uncultivated parts of the lots, gardens, and orchards. The seed come to maturity by the 10th of May in most instances. If medicinal properties were claimed for a plant, Lewis mentioned them. If the claim touched a common medical problem back in the States, Lewis emphasized it, none more so than a root known by the name of White Wood of the Prairie, which was said to be sovereign for the bite of a mad wolf or a mad dog, and for the bite of the rattlesnake. Rabies and snakebite were common dangers in the early 19th century, so a cure was such an exciting prospect that Lewis made the root of the white wood the subject of a separate letter to Jefferson, in which he detailed how to prepare it as a poultice, how to apply it, and so forth. He concluded, "I have sent herewith a few pounds of this root, in order that experiments may be made by some skillful person under the direction of the Philosophical Society of Philadelphia." It was probably the purple coneflower, which was widely used by the Indians as an antidote for snakebite. Jefferson sent the root along to a doctor to experiment with it. Lewis also sent to Jefferson 68 mineral specimens, all labeled as to where and when collected. He included such items as sand of the Missouri, 1 pint of Missouri water, pebbles common to the Missouri, lead ore, quartz, globular salts, alum, pyrites, lime, lava and pumice stone, and fossils. The plants and minerals were part of a larger shipment to Jefferson that included skeletons of a male and female pronghorn, the horns of 2 mule deer, insects and mice, skins of various animals, including a marten and a white weasel that came from beyond the mountains via the trade route, and more. There were live animals, too, new to science. 4 magpies, a prairie dog, and a prairie grouse hen. Only 1 magpie and the prairie dog reached Jefferson alive. Included also in the shipment was Clark's map of the United States west of the Mississippi River. It was a masterpiece of the cartographer's art and an invaluable contribution to knowledge. From St. Louis to Fort Mandan, Clark got it exactly right along the Missouri. His map became a bit sketchier as it moved west, naturally, because his depictions of the various tributaries was based on hearsay, often from people who did not claim to be eyewitnesses but knew someone who had been there. Lewis explained Clark's method. He would compare one Indian's description with another's, questioning them separately and at different times, and questioning as many as possible. Only when there was agreement on placement, distance, mountain passes, and so forth, was the information put on Clark's map and into Lewis's report. For all their concern with getting the specimens ready for shipment and with making their report and the map as complete as possible, in the first 2 weeks of spring, what was uppermost in the captains' minds was what lay ahead. They pumped the Mandans, who never ventured very far west and thus could tell them little, and the Hidatsas, whose war parties ranged to the mountains and who thus could tell them a lot. From the Hidatsas, Lewis had learned the names of rivers coming into the Missouri and their connections with one another. He commented on his source, "I conceive the Hidatsas are entitled to some confidence." Lewis expected to find, at 117 miles upriver from Fort Mandan, the White Earth River coming in on the north side. The prospect excited him greatly, because if the White Earth came in from as far north as the Indians indicated, it would mean that the boundary between Canada and the United States might be moved north by as much as a full degree of latitude, something Jefferson very much hoped for. 3 miles above the mouth of the White Earth, the Indians told Lewis he would come to the greatest of all the tributaries of the Missouri, the Yellowstone. The Hidatsas said that the Yellowstone waters one of the fairest portions of Louisiana, a country not yet hunted, and abounding in animals of the fur kind. They thought the river navigable at all seasons of the year for boats and pirogues to the foot of the Rocky Mountains, near which place it is said to be not more than 20 miles distant from the Three Forks of the Missouri. The obvious importance of the Yellowstone led Lewis to recommend that the government build a trading post at the junction with the Missouri. It would afford to our citizens the benefit of a most lucrative fur trade and might be made to hold in check the views of the British Northwest Company, whose intention was to panoplize the Missouri River fur trade business. If this powerful and ambitious company are suffered uninterruptedly to prosecute their trade, Lewis warned, the British might someday use their influence with the natives to block all American navigation on the Missouri. Some 150 miles upstream from the mouth of the Yellowstone would come the river which scolds at all others, falling in on the north side. Then the Mussel Shell from the south. Another 120 miles and the expedition would be at the falls of the Missouri, described by the Indians as a most tremendous cataract. They state that the noise it makes can be heard at a great distance. They also state that there is a fine open plain on the north side of the falls, through which canoes and baggage may be readily transported. This portage, they assert, is not greater than a half a mile. Some 15 miles beyond the falls, the Medicine River would fall in on the north side. Another 60 miles, and the expedition would enter the first connected chain of the mountains. After another 75 miles, the Missouri would divide into three nearly equal branches at the place called Three Forks, where Sacagawea had been captured some 5 years earlier. The most northern of the three rivers is navigable to the foot of a chain of high mountains, being the ridge which divides the waters of the Atlantic from those of the Pacific Ocean. The Indians assert that they can pass in half a day from the foot of this mountain on its east side to a large river which washes its western base. How Jefferson must have loved reading that line. The singular objective of the expedition was about to be realized. The divide was as far as the Hidatsas ever ventured. Lewis noted that, "We have therefore been unable to acquire any information further west than the view from the top of these mountains." But what the Hidatsas said they saw from the top of the mountains was exactly what Lewis and Jefferson hoped for and expected. The Indians inform us that the country on the western side of this river consists of open and level plains like those they themselves inhabit. The Flathead and Shoshone tribes lived on a river in that country. Their principal food was fish. "This river we suppose to be the South Fork of the Columbia," Lewis wrote, "and the fish the salmon, with which we are informed the Columbia River abounds. This river is said to be rapid, but as far as the Indian informants are acquainted with it, is not intercepted with shoals." What had been high expectations now soared, both at Fort Mandan and some months later in Washington, when the report arrived and Jefferson read it with what must have been the most intense satisfaction, feeling that, even as he was reading, the all-water route to the Pacific was being found and mapped. Along with the report, Lewis sent back to St. Louis various letters, dispatches, and copies of the drafts and chits he had signed, what he called "my public accounts." In a covering letter to Jefferson dated April 7th, but almost certainly written the previous day, Lewis confessed to considerable embarrassment about those accounts. He had intended to put them in order and have them returned to St. Louis in the fall of 1804, but in the event it turned out that "the provision pirogue and her crew could not have been dismissed without evidently, in my opinion, hazarding the fate of the enterprise in which I am engaged, and I therefore did not hesitate to prefer the censure that I may have incurred by the detention of these papers to that of risking in any degree the success of the expedition." Jefferson had instructed Lewis to be diligent about his accounts and to get his drafts back to the War Department with all possible speed. Lewis said his failure to do so had become "a serious source of disquiet and anxiety, and the recollection of your particular charge to me on this subject has made it still more poignant." Clearly, as an Army officer, Lewis had made the correct decision, but as the President's protege, he felt terrible about it because he hated disappointing Jefferson. Yet, however bad he felt about it, Lewis's casualness with his accounts and the chits he had signed was becoming habitual. In the second half of his April 7th letter to Jefferson, Lewis told his commander-in-chief his plans. In the morning, he intended to send the keelboat and pirogues on their way. Accompanying Corporal Worthington would be four privates plus Newman and Reed, Mr. Gravelines acting as interpreter, and four Frenchmen. They were well armed and adequately supplied. "I have but little doubt but they will be fired on by the Sioux," Lewis wrote, "but they have pledged themselves to us that they will not yield while there is a man of them living." The expedition's six canoes and two pirogues were loaded, ready to go. They would shove off the instant Worthington turned the keelboat downstream. Lewis said he intended to leave the two pirogues at the falls of the Missouri. On the far side of the falls, he intended to put his iron frame boat together and cover it with skins. Freed of the cumbersome keelboat, Lewis said he anticipated traveling at a rate of 20 to 25 miles per day until he reached the falls. After that, "any calculation with respect to our daily progress can be little more than bare conjecture." But his hopes were high. "The circumstance of the Snake Indians possessing large quantities of horses is much in our favor, as by means of horses the transportation of our baggage will be rendered easy and expeditious over land, from the Missouri to the Columbia River." Supplies were adequate, Lewis said, thanks to the skills of the hunters, whose efforts made it possible to live on a diet of meat, thus saving the parched corn, portable soup, flour, and salt pork for the mountains. He put in not a word about Mandan corn, a glaring omission that left Jefferson with the entirely wrong impression that it was possible for white men to winter on the plains without help from the Indians. Lewis did say that the Indians assured him the country ahead abounds with a vast quantity of game. Lewis predicted that the expedition would reach the Pacific Ocean that summer, then return as far as the head of the Missouri, or perhaps even as far as Fort Mandan, for the winter of 1805-6. He told Jefferson, "You may, therefore, expect me to meet you at Monticello in September 1806." Lewis's concluding paragraph must be the most optimistic report from the field from an Army officer about to set off on a great venture that any commander-in-chief ever received. "I can foresee no material or probable obstruction to our progress, and entertain, therefore, the most sanguine hopes of complete success. As to myself individually, I never enjoyed a more perfect state of good health than I have since we commenced our voyage. My inestimable friend and companion, Captain Clark, has also enjoyed good health generally. At this moment, every individual of the party are in good health and excellent spirits. Zealously attached to the enterprise and anxious to proceed, not a whisper of discontent or murmur is to be heard among them, but all in unison act with the most perfect harmony. With such men, I have everything to hope and but little to fear." Chapter 18. From Fort Mandan to Marias River, April 7th to June 2nd, 1805. In the morning and early part of the afternoon of April 7th, 1805, Lewis was busy overseeing the last-minute wrapping of packages and their placement into the canoes that would head upriver to the mountains, or into the keelboat that was going downstream to St. Louis. He checked weapons, powder, food and medical stocks, trade goods, and implements. He gave last-minute instructions to Corporal Richard Worthington in command of the keelboat.